What's up, everyone? Welcome back to Dr. Lee Unhinged. I'm Dr. Shaw.
Dr. Maxfield.
And today we have the best episode we've ever created. And today we're going to be talking about week. I say this every week. It's good. You got to build the hype in the very beginning, you know. So today we're going to do a little bit of life update. Really nothing's going on in my life, so I have really nothing to say. Then we're going to be talking about our product of the day. Just random things we try. So Dr. Maxfield and I, we try like a lot of things because we get sent a lot of things, right? So we're not going out there. I do buy products still, but a lot of them get sent to us. So we try them so we can give you some feedback so that you know what to buy and what not to buy. So we're going to be talking about our product of the day. Then we're going to be talking about unsexy products. This is a trend on social media where we talk about products that are not sexy, but certainly work. And then something big, hot off the press, that is going to probably affect any employer in the United States. And that's the FTC now finally banning non-compete agreements. And what does that mean for us? What does that mean for you? We're going to be getting into that.
Right. So this is particularly relevant to us. I think first off, as the life updates, though, similar to you, I have absolutely nothing going on. I got back from the trip and got right back into work, which is great. Love what I do. And that was my entire week. Absolutely nothing is happening.
It's great to love what you do and get and want to be back to doing what you do, right? You go to Paris, right? And you would think, oh, well, that's the highlight. But I think what should be is like the highlights of, you know, the moments shouldn't just be like the short periods. It should be the things you're doing the most, right? You know, you sleep more than you do other things, right? So make sure that your sleeping is nice, right? Like your bed is, you know what I mean? Like the things, a lot of times people focus a lot of their energy on times and the things they do the least, right? But you should really try to make the things that you do the most and spend the most time on the most pleasant of times and experiences.
Yeah. Okay. So there you go. Life lesson from Dr. Shaw. I actually do agree with you tremendously on that point. To that point, we bought a coffee maker. Like, ooh, you know, you have yours.
Yeah.
I've come to realize how nice that is. And so we bought a I don't know. We bought it at Target.
You have to, if you're going to buy a coffee maker in 2024, you have to do a lot of research on the coffee. You can't just go in and buy what you see at Target first. Like, this is a research heavy you should have asked me. We did so much research on our coffee maker.
Oh, did you? Yeah. I mean, it's a nice one. It's definitely more than I would have ever purchased before, but I came to the realization, I mean, honestly, it had to do with France too. France, the coffee was so good. It's just so fresh and so like full and rich. I couldn't go back to the crap I was drinking before. What are you made some iced coffee. He's holding up his coffee.
This is my oat milk iced latte that I make every day, every morning now. I use the Breville Barista Touch machine, and it's so consistent and it's so good. And I can tweak it to exactly what I want, from the bitterness to the flavor. Just a phenomenal drink. If anyone ever meets me, I will make you one of these. This is my signature drink and it's phenomenal. You know what I did the other day, separate from this on the same line? I thought I was a genius. So Oatly is the oat milk company that I buy the oat milk for my oat milk lattes from, right? I think Oatly is the best. I've tried a bunch of different oat milks, and Oatly has ice cream actually. So I saw that they had ice cream. And specifically, they have coffee ice cream. So I was like, I'm going to put oat milk, Oatly ice cream, coffee ice cream in my oat milk latte. And that is going to take it to the next level. Like a scoop I would put in the coffee. Wasn't good.
No? Oh, okay. Because so I think it was my third year of residency, maybe second year. For probably 6 months straight, you know, at the office, the main office, in the freezer, there's like always tubs of ice cream in there. I don't know who they belong to. I think they're community tubs. Let's just assume they are. But every day I would get a scoop of ice cream and put it in my coffee for a solid 6 months. And that was my creamer. And that was outstanding. But I could see how oat milk ice cream wouldn't go as far. I've had rice ice cream. I grew up with that. Also kind of watery, not delicious, melted down.
Yeah. If I got like a Breyers vanilla scoop in here, that would have been a game changer. But I really thought that this was going to be like complimenting the whole experience, and it just didn't, it didn't have the effect that I anticipated when I made this drink. For some reason, it also like attracted a lot of like ants to the drink. I don't know. Anyway, I was outside when I was drinking this. Anyway, coffee makers at home, finding a good one saves you a ton of money. And like over the, amortization period, as we discussed last time, right? Like, let's say that you get Starbucks coffee, which I haven't had Starbucks in like a year. Let's say you get a coffee, it costs like $5-6 every yes. day. And you do that, that's $1,800 a year. I don't know if I did the math right on that, but let's say it's about $2,000 a year. The coffee maker, let's say even an expensive one, is like $1,000, right? You would pay it off in a year just making coffee at home. And I would argue, and I like people, you know, all the Dave Ramseys of the world who talk about personal finance will tell you, just don't buy coffee. Listen, you have to enjoy life. But I would argue that this coffee is better and going to save you money.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Okay, so I got the DeLonghi.
Oh, that's a good one.
True Brew. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's the flavor. I mean, it's great. It's just a huge step up. And I kind of had, again, that same moment. I was like, you know, this is something I do every day. And I'm expecting this to last me years and years and years. And also to keep my wife from going to Starbucks. Like, the quality is better. I enjoy the moment. I think in the long run, it's actually going to pay itself off more quickly than you'd realize. So I completely agree with the sentiment. Take an action.
If you're both making coffee every day, it's going to pay itself off in 3 months. Hmm?
There it is.
Yeah. So there you go. All right. So let's go into a life update. This episode will release on the launch day of our next Remedy product. Wait. So if it's out, I can say the name of the product. We are launching Remedy for body bumps today. I don't even know how I didn't think of this. Okay, Remedy for body bumps. This is an all-in-one treatment for KP. It's going to have phenomenal benefits in crepey skin. It has urea, lactic acid, and retinol in a body product. It's absolutely phenomenal. The packaging is beautiful. I don't have it with me right now.
You never have it. I still haven't seen the packaging. This is trash. I'm going to see the packaging when the video goes live.
Yeah, you probably are. We'll flash it up on the screen if you're watching on YouTube. Phenomenal product. I'm super proud of it. It took us a really, really long time to make. Hope you love it. Definitely check it out at remedyskin.com. I don't know how this wasn't the intro of this episode, but I didn't realize the times were going to collide. So Remedy for body bumps, definitely check it out. Hope you love it. We have free shipping on launch day. So we don't do free shipping other times. So just on launch day, you'll get free shipping no matter how much you spend. So definitely go check it out. And hopefully we'll have international shipping one day soon, but not yet still.
Nice. Perfect. And I think this will pair with a deeper dive on YouTube about the product. So if you want to learn more, you can go to YouTube. It's Dr. Maxfield at youtube.com. No, I'm just kidding. It's Dr. Lee. Look us up. Okay, so that's super exciting. Like, I know this product stacks up. I can't wait for people to try it, get the feedback, et cetera, et cetera. So big moment for you. That's going to be wonderful. Can't wait to see the launch.
All right. So let's jump into our product of the day. Product of the day. What have you been loving?
So I've got some hair stuff. This one is a Durkos. They have a dandruff shampoo in the EU. I really like this line, this Durkos line from the EU. I went to the French pharmacies and I was looking actually for a different product. Well, I was looking for a few products, but this one had the other one they didn't have from La Roche-Posay, the Carium something something. I don't know if that even exists anymore. In the store online.
Which one is it? Which Durkos?
This one is their dandruff one. It's in the green box. Is it their Regen? No, the Regen's their hairline. Dandruff shampoo. It's just called dandruff shampoo. So Vichy Durkos anti-dandruff shampoo. They have a few different types for different hair and scalp types. Mine, I just got the one for normal to oily. Mm-hmm. And it has salicylic and selenium sulfide. It's a nice dual combo. The thing I like about it, it leaves your hair pretty soft. I was kind of surprised. The nice thing is I caught the initial reaction on camera with all of these products I did, and I did like it a lot. Fragrance, hit or miss, the smell, not sure if I love it, but the product itself, functional use, I absolutely love.
Yeah, that's one of the frustrating things about shampoos in general, is that most of them are going to have ingredients that we don't necessarily love for this rest of the skin. And that could be, you know, whether it's the fragrance or whatever is in it, right? You know, Nizoral, one of my favorite anti-dandruff shampoos, you know, this Durko shampoo, all probably fragranced and unfortunate. Even like Garnier's, which I use quite a bit of. And if you've stayed with me, so you probably see that Garnier shampoos all over the place. the Garnier like Bond Repair line also kind of a ton of fragrance in it, but works really well. So that's the challenge, is like, can we get a product that works really well that's fragrance free? I just think that consumers are not quite there yet with,
right,
with hair products, where they still want their hair to smell good. And you know, I can understand that. So I don't suspect that the fragrance free movement is going to take over hair anytime soon, unfortunately.
I know, it's surprising.
Unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know that I have a super strong opinion about it, actually.
Really? I don't know if I... I guess I don't have a strong opinion on any part of skincare. It's like, just know what it does or doesn't do. But I feel like there should be a niche for it. There's like certain products where just the gentle fragrance-free version almost doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Like deodorant. If you see a Dr. Maxfield deodorant coming out soon, just know that it is going to be completely fragrance-free, not unscented. Like if you go... I had an allergic reaction in my armpit. I went to the store to try to buy a fragrance-free deodorant. It does not exist. Like the unscented ones all have fragrance in it. It literally just says straight up fragrance in the ingredient line. And we know why that is. It's not used as fragrance. It's just like in there to be technical. But the product...
Well, the reason is too. because deodorants, I don't know if you're using this word on purpose, but deodorants are meant to mask for, are meant to be fragrance maskers, right?
Right.
So like they're always going to, but like, what about, did you find a fragrance-free antiperspirant or no?
I mean, yeah, I was using the word deodorant as the... Just, you know, the thing you...
The category?
Stick you by,
okay,
the store.
So then you couldn't even find an antiperspirant that was fragrance-free.
Correct.
Ooh, yeah. Okay.
It just, like, doesn't exist. I know they exist, but they are hard to find. And even then, they usually have something in them. But like hair follows suit too. The Ordinary had their shampoo, which, you know, it was very stripped down. I absolutely hated it.
Really?
It just has no lather. It has no body. It was...
That's
there.
So interesting, because wasn't this the shampoo that they were like saying, oh, we're going to put sulfates in it, and you know, we're all, you know, we have sulfates, like almost like embracing, like, cause you know, there's a lot of anti-sulfate, mm-hmm, people out there, and they were almost trying to do like an anti-sulfate thing. And so they used sulfates in it. And the actually the hardest thing was with formulating a shampoo, being on the other side of it now, is the limitations in the surfactant. So the surfactant is like the actual cleansing agent, and it's usually the foaming agent in the product. And the challenge with the surfactants a lot of times is that and you're limited with the surfactants you can use based on like some of the consumers' concerns about certain ingredients, that sulfates are one of the better surfactants, unfortunately. Mm. And so a lot of people don't use them anymore, and you can get a lot of good foaming out of some of the sulfate based cleansers. So it's sort of interesting that they were able to use any surfactant because they were like embracing like the anti-clean movement and then still didn't foam the shampoo.
Yeah, that's a great point. I love their idea. Like if you look at my shirt today, I'm wearing the No Rules Just Reason shirt, kind of again, like being thoughtful.
I love it.
But and so I loved the attitude from The Ordinary in the creation of this, but it functionally was a miss for me. In terms of what I like out of a shampoo.
Shampoos are tough, like to find somebody who's going to love everything. But I agree, like with shampoos, like I need a nice lather. Like I need to feel like my hair is getting clean by this shampoo. So I'm 100% with you. All right, let's move on to my product here. So this is what I do sometimes. Sometimes I put products like in my bathroom and I'm like, all right, I'll use this later. I don't know if you do this.
Yeah, I do. That's the only way to get used.
Because if I put it in my like skincare room, this is not a problem that anybody has except for people like us who create content around skincare products. So this is not going to be universally helpful to anybody. But I have a skincare room that I'm shooting this video in right now. And when I get products, if I put them in this room, they almost never get used and they ended up just getting given away. But if I put it in my bathroom, there's a high likelihood that it will get used on my face at some point. So this product I put in my bathroom, and it is the Charlotte Tilbury Magic Water Cream.
Yeah, I got that right here.
Magic Water Cream, and it's fragrance-free. This is the fragrance-free version of this product. So this is a fragrance-free, and it's got some niacinamide in it. It's got the ingredients that you would find in a moisturizer, okay? Nothing exciting to call out here, let's just say. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Performance wise, phenomenal product, really phenomenal product. I actually love the way it's on my face right now. I love the way that this product makes my skin look. It's a lightweight gel, and it almost, I don't know how to explain it, but it gives your skin like a glow all day without being like greasy at all. And it really is a nice product. The problem is it's $100, which to me is just way too much for a moisturizer. So I'm so conflicted on this product because I do think it's a nice product that people will really like. Try it right now.
Yeah. So I found it. It took me, I dropped everything in the process of getting this off the shelf. But yeah, I'm going to use it. I've tried the other one. I haven't tried this one. Lid goes on the floor for the moment and for the next week.
It's a lot of moisturizer.
I got a big face. Okay. All right. I like it a lot. So with this one is I have the water cream though. You were talking about the water gel. I actually don't have the water gel. Darn it.
This is the water cream.
Water cream. Magic okay. Cause yeah, I don't have a gel lotion from them.
But it's like a gel texture, I feel.
So I like it. I'd say it's like a, how to describe it. It does have like a full body. It's very hydrating though. Like very hydrating. How much did you say this was?
100.
100?
For 1.7 fluid ounces.
Okay. See, it's hard. I do like it a lot. In this, my rule of thumb is always if it hurts your budget and if you're budgeting for a product, you really should think 5 times before buying it. But I do like this product too. Good call.
Yeah, this is a nice one. And I think it's got the dry down that you see with like shea butter. Like if you ever used a product that's like high in shea butter, which a lot of hand creams are, it's got that feel like where it just dries down so well. Anyway, I really like it a lot. So shout out to them. All right. So let's move on to our first topic, which is the unsexy products that actually work. So this is a trend on social media where people talk about products that you wouldn't usually get a lot of hype. They don't have cute packaging, and we're going to be talking about those. So what product do you have? Because I feel like we didn't share the products in advance. So unsexy products that work, what's your number one?
Oh, number one. Okay. I hate to say this one because it's not new, but it's like Vaseline.
The secret, that's mine. That's on my
list. It has to be. The secret is out on this goopy thick thing because it's like super good at what it does. It's extremely occlusive, extremely physically inert. It's like the ultimate locking in occlusive to elevate other ingredients or even elevate your other moisturizers in the setting of slugging. And again, it's the cheapest ingredient on the shelf. So to be a top tier in its unique category and be as inexpensive as it is, it's probably my number one.
Okay. Yeah. So I agree with you. Vaseline has got so many uses. I mean, dry lips, irritation around the eyes, wound repair, after a surgery, help prevent scarring in the initial period, as a slugging ointment to repair the skin barrier, to help lock in other ingredients. Like there are so many things that Vaseline can do. I think everyone should at least have it in their skincare repertoire, and just keep it there in case they need it for an emergency. Now, I do believe, you know, I really kind of like locked in on this. I don't think, and you know, just because it's pure petrolatum and it doesn't really bring in any other lipids or any other emollients to the picture, I do think it's not like the most hydrating, you know. And I actually do think, even though Aquaphor has lanolin in it, which is like the contact allergen of the year from like 2023 or whatever, I actually find Aquaphor to be incredibly more hydrating than Vaseline is, despite its allergic risk.
Yeah, that's why I love layering with Vaseline, because I do agree, if you use it on your own, it doesn't add much. But that's why with wounds, you know, wounds are weepy, wounds are wet, and your body is sending fluid to heal the surgical site. And so Vaseline petrolatum is the natural occlusive, because your body provides the fluid, the Vaseline locks it in, the wound subsequently heals faster, better. That's how that works.
Probably if I had to say, like, there would be like a Nobel Prize for a skincare ingredient, I would say pure petrolatum should be like ingredient of the century.
Wow. Bold. Tretinoin step aside. Petrolatum is the king. Okay. I love it. All right. Well, what's yours since I took petrolatum?
Well, you took mine. The next would be Nizoral shampoo. So Nizoral shampoo, incredible anti-dandruff shampoo, not sexy, doesn't smell great, usually like hidden somewhere on a shelf in Target, doesn't get a lot of play, but you see a lot of derms talking about it. It's incredible anti-dandruff shampoo. It also has other benefits, like it can help with seborrheic dermatitis on the face. It can help with tinea versicolor on the body. It can help with any type of fungal foot infections. And I like using it with a scalp scrubber. I don't think we really talk about that much, but there are these like rubber scalp scrubbers that help to kind of get it deeper into the scalp, especially if you have longer hair. So I use Nizoral with a scalp scrubber. It's not sexy, but it gets its uses about 1 to 2 times a week.
Nice. Yeah, Nizoral is a hero ingredient. I mean, it's the only over-the-counter ketoconazole, and ketoconazole is a hero ingredient that nothing else really can replace at the moment. So I agree.
And hair loss. Helps with hair loss.
All right. So my next one, no one cares about this product, although I've noticed a lot of brands are using it and some people are talking about, but hypochlorous acid. I've propped this up so much. Like, I should have a company purely revolving around this product. But the reason I like hypochlorous acid so much is it's a completely non-irritating functional cleanser, and it is gentle as can be. Like, you have a paper cut, you use this to clean it. You have a wound, you use this to clean it. They use it in the hospitals for wound care. You have acne, you can use this throughout the day to help decrease the bacteria, especially if you're an athlete, can't do a full skin reset. And then for hand sanitizers, like, everyone still is probably in the habit of using sanitizer more frequently than they had previously. And for us who have to wash our hands every time we leave a room, we know the effects of alcohol and drying the skin. This is a completely gentle product, does not destroy the skin barrier like alcohol or frequent hand washing. So for like daily life, I feel like hypochlorous acid has a ton of use.
Yeah, no, 100%. Hypochlorous acid has a lot of benefits. Super gentle cleanser. You can spray it on your back after you work out. If you're someone who's prone to back acne, can really help to decolonize any buildup there. And again, super gentle, gentle enough to use it on the face, spray it in the face. I feel super comfortable with that. And the other thing to think about with it is that it, because it has powerful oxidizing abilities, similar to benzoyl peroxide in the sense that its action is, its action as an antiseptic, antibacterial agent is by oxidizing things. And if you think about vitamin C and other antioxidants, they work by stopping oxidizing, right? So if you use vitamin C and hypochlorous acid together, theoretically, and there's not really studies on this, they would cancel out some of their benefits for each other. So with hypochlorous acid, you would want to spray it, wait for it to dry, wait for it to have its killing action on the skin, anti-inflammatory action on the skin, and then apply your vitamin C if you wanted to use them at the same time of the day or use them at opposite times of the day. But I do believe just based on like the way it works, that hypochlorous acid would deactivate an L-ascorbic acid vitamin C product.
See, I think that, and I don't know if there will ever be a study on this. I think that's something that people need to come to terms with, is a lot of these things we just theorize based off of the mechanism. And I mean, who's going to study it? Like, no one except for a point of interest would take the time to do this, but people don't understand the amount of work that goes into creating a study, especially like a well-done clinical study. So with this, a lot of other ingredients, copper peptides, vitamin C, a lot of these interactions, they're theorized based off of physiology mechanism. And maybe there's a study out there showing how ingredients work together, but not in the setting of skin. But I completely agree with that anecdote and that nuance.
I'd be okay with like an experiment, like a really like, why don't you and I do an experiment at one point, try to figure out how we can. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I already thought about how to do it, and I think we could probably pull it off.
All right. I love it. Coming soon. The one, N of one, but it's going to be cool. I love it.
All right. Next up, let's see. What else do you have?
Oh, you know what? This one, it's it kind of feels weird bringing in a semi-prescription ingredient that's over the counter. And I'm not talking, I'm not talking about adapalene. But that is sure good at what it does. I was actually going to go with miconazole, and this is the monostat, the ingredient you use down there, but you could also use up there, up here, up anywhere, because this is actually a pretty decent antifungal cream, and a lot of people have fungal problems. So like just like Dr. Shah was talking about, just like you were talking about with like fungal acne and all these things, they're very common problems, such as tinea versicolor, where you get those light or dark spots on the trunk. There is intertrigo, where you get irritation and inflammation, sometimes just from the environment, but sometimes a form of it can be infectious from yeast. You can get athlete's foot. I mean, onychomycosis, toenail infections with fungus, although this would not be particularly helpful because nothing is particularly helpful. But again, this is a very effective targeted ingredient that's over the counter and readily available for anyone. And it could be very useful for someone who's needing something to treat fungus on their skin.
Yeah, 100%. This is something I recommend all the time, especially when I'm on lives, and something that is incredibly effective for many, many different things. I mean, when you scrape anyone's skin, and a lot of people don't realize this, is that when you scrape your skin and you look at it underneath the microscope, there's all kinds of organisms living on the skin. That is your funguses, your mites, your bacteria, and they usually live in harmony, but when they overgrow, they cause different skin conditions. And an ingredient like myconazole can do a really good job at eliminating some of those fungus and yeast on the skin, and that can make a huge difference to this low-level inflammation, corner of the nose, corner of the mouth, tinea versicolor, seborrheic dermatitis. Mm-hmm. We never really talk about it, but it works incredibly, incredibly well, but it's something that your dermatologist would tell you if you go to see them. So this is a dermatologist hack that is not very sexy.
Nice. Okay. What do you have? I'm surprised. I want to know, because I have my list. I want to see what else you hit that's crossing over.
Well, now I have to add, because I didn't have really any more. So now I got to reach for the stars. So now that you brought up myconazole, I'm going to take it one step further and say that there is now available an ivermectin lotion available over the counter. Okay. So ivermectin lotion, it's actually a lotion that I believe is used for lice. And so it is the active ingredient that you find in Sclice, and it is now available over the counter. You can get it at Walgreens for like $35, which is kind of expensive. What does ivermectin also do? It's a phenomenal ingredient to treat rosacea for a lot of people. Now, in rosacea, we usually use like a 1%, and it's very, very expensive. And this one is 0.5% available over the counter. And the other ingredients in that formula, the Walgreens version, is like not the best ingredients on earth. But if you have demodexosis, whatever you call that condition, where you get an overgrowth of Demodex mites on the skin, and it causes inflammation, redness, or you have rosacea that's induced by these mites, ivermectin makes a big difference in some of my patients there. So for rosacea prone patients, ivermectin is always worth a chance, and now available over the counter, a little hack that's pretty unsexy.
And now we will go on to what is, again, very relevant to a lot of people, including ourselves and the people we train and the people we train with. The FTC has banned non-competes. So for everyone out there who doesn't know, because this doesn't apply quite to every employee, but what is a non-compete? What does that terminology mean?
So generally in a lot of contracts that you sign as an employee, there's usually something in it that says that there's a non-compete clause, and they become oftentimes more and more enforced and talked about in positions as you kind of scale up into management. And basically the way that they work is they generally say you can't work in a certain industry or certain location for a certain period of time after you terminate your employment with that company. So like in a classic example, let's say in the physician space, would be you cannot practice dermatology within 15 miles of this practice for 2 years. And that would be like a classic non-compete. So let's say you leave that practice. The concern from the employer standpoint is that you would leave the practice and open up shop right next door and start stealing their patients. And so they say, you can't do that within like a 15-mile radius for 2 years. And so if you want to continue to practice dermatology locally, you have to move 15 miles out so that we're not in the same sort of sphere. And so that's what it works like in dermatology. Let's say in other industries, it will say something like you can't work in the same sort of industry even, right? Like let's say that I own a skincare company, a traditional non-compete for Remedy could look like you can't work for a skincare brand for a year, right? So you would have to take those skills and do something else with them outside of skincare. Like let's say you go into, I don't know, selling blankets or something like that. So those are what non-competes look like. They basically tell you that you can't compete with the practice, like the practice or business that you are coming from after you leave.
So it is very relevant, especially to people who have a unique niche skill set, because it not only prohibits you from providing that service in an area, but it also prevents the people in the area from getting your service. And so again, for us as doctors, it's very relevant, because if you have a unique skill set, like Mohs surgery, even dermatology is for a doctor a pretty difficult thing to obtain, and therefore, unfortunately, there are not enough of us, the people who are in the area might be lacking when you leave. And also, though, there, again, there's like this purist side of it that we talked about last week, the relational side of it. You know, you do build relationships with patients. There is a huge trust factor. Even if the physician-patient relationship is dead, there's still a huge trust factor in those brief moments you share with your patients that I've experienced. And so if you have to move to a different city to practice medicine, you're going to lose that, and they're going to miss out, and they're going to be the ultimate losers in that as well. The thing that's interesting, though, this has probably been a long time coming. Anytime we sign a non-compete, which we have probably signed in the course of our lives at this point, a lot of people say, it's not enforceable anyway. You have to go through the trouble of probably getting a lawyer and at least being ready to go to court over it. But there is an idea that a lot of these have not been enforceable for some time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on how, you know, petty people want to be ultimately. So some people will enforce non-competes, certainly, and especially amongst executives in businesses, right? So Let's say that you're the chief operating officer of an insurance company and you leave for a competing insurance company and you take with you many trade secrets that made the other company successful, and you really know the inner workings of what's making this business work, and you take that to another company. I do believe that a lot of businesses would enforce that non-compete because the material loss from something like that could be massive for the business, especially if it's, you know, some type of trade secret that, you know, really is making you stand out in the space, and you don't want other, you know, competing businesses to know that. Now, the thing in medicine, and I've always felt strongly about this, is that non-competes are really, really detrimental, like you said, to the local patient population and to the physician themselves, but also just like an access to care issue in general, right? To say, hey, you have to work here and then you can't work in this geographic region. And it causes a lot of people to completely like uproot their lives. I've seen a lot of physicians do that, where they do have a falling out of the practice they're at, you know, some type of business disagreement, and then they have to move their whole family and kids to another area. They have to change school districts. Like, it becomes a kind of a huge nightmare for people. And at the same time, now you have less access to care in that area. And a lot of people have built trust with you and they want to stay with you. And the thing is, usually too, with non-competes, non-compete, non-solicited, is you're not even allowed to tell people where you went. You can't even like reach out to your existing patients, right? You basically like leave care, and you're not allowed to tell the patient in the middle of their care journey where you went, right? And, you know, if you have good documentation, they can probably pick up care where you left off, but it's a huge disservice to people who, you know, you've been on a journey with them for, you know, 6-8 months on a particular treatment, and then you leave and you're not allowed really to tell people where you went or how to find you.
Yeah. So again, doctors, that's very relevant to us. When this first came out, you know, most of the residents that I knew across programs, they were all texting about this. They were all texting. This is a game changer for doctors, because majority of doctors are employees now, the vast majority. Mm-hmm. And so just like anyone else, we are subject to a lot of the restrictions that are put upon us. And so you can get into a not ideal employer situation pretty easily. Like, and companies change hands now. So doctors find themselves under new ownership quite frequently as well. And so this really impacts doctors and their flexibility and freedom. And I think everyone, at least their initial reaction, a lot of people in this space were pretty excited about it. Now, I think now there is the other side of it too, though, where you have to look at it from an employer standpoint as well. Because like you said, with these trade secrets, with people who are performing a very specific service, like, it could be catastrophic to a company if this completely went away and that person was able to set up shop across the street being a competitor. So there is another side to this too.
Yeah, there is so much nuance to this one that I wish I had like a strong opinion, like one way where I said, like, this is what I believe it should do, which I do. I feel like in a lot of things we talk about, I have this like, okay, this is my direction, I'm sticking with it. This one's really, really tough and nuanced, because I do think that this severely limits competition, right? Like one of the things that the FTC is saying is that the final ruling banning non-competes will generate over 8,500 new businesses each year, raise worker wages, lower healthcare costs, and boost innovation. Why do they think that this is going to boost innovation, increase jobs, et cetera, is because basically what will happen is that people will be able to leave. They'll be able to open competing businesses. That increase in competition will lead to more innovation in both the business you left and the new business that formed. It also will raise worker wages because people will have to try to retain their employees better, right? They'll have to figure out ways to incentivize them. Now, I've worked in many different scenarios. I do know some people that I've worked with that weaponize non-competes. They do it with nefarious intent. And there are people who use non-competes truly to protect the business and to protect their innovation within that business. And that's why there's so much nuance to this one, because the people who weaponize non-competes are the reason why non-competes should be banned. And I believe they should be banned. These are the type of people who put a non-compete in place. They don't ever increase your wages. They make the working conditions horrible, but they know that you can't leave because you have a child that's in the local elementary school, and the non-compete is so far reaching that you would have to move, uproot your entire family and life. And so they never increase your wages. They make the working conditions horrible, and they make sure that you can't leave because otherwise it would be massively detrimental to your life, right? And some people weaponize it, and that leads to lower wages. That leads to less innovation, that increased cost, that, you know, right? Because they can locally control the market. So there are certainly people who have in the past used non-competes really to stranglehold their employees. So I think that's wrong. I think it's especially wrong in medicine, because the people who end up getting harmed mostly are the patients. And I truly believe that, you know, as somebody who now has several businesses, employees should stay because they want to stay, and they should be incentivized to stay by rewarding them for the work that they're doing and increasing their wages when the company is doing well and giving them positive feedback. And people should stay because they like being there. You're going to get a person who works harder, is better at their job if they want to be there. So like my belief is that, you know, employers should incentivize employees to stay through other means, not by like capturing them and keeping them prisoner of a non-compete. That's such a bad way, in my opinion, to run a business. Now, the flipped nuance side of this is I do believe that, like, let's say that you do have a business where a trade secret or a competitive edge that you have is something that you came up with on your own, and that competitive edge is now going with that employee, and they're going to use it. Now, there are things that are separate from non-competes that are meant to stop that from happening, which is there you can have contracts, which this non-compete law is not going to eliminate, which is non-disclosure agreements, which, you know, a lot of employees sign that basically say, I'm not going to tell anybody else what's happening at this business, and trade secret laws, where you basically say, like, this is a trade secret that I do, and that trade secret you can't tell to other people. The problem is that, like, the value of that employee a lot of times is that trade secret, right? So, like, let's say, for example, going back to the insurance company, like, let's say that your competitive edge is an insurance company. You're just crushing everybody. You're blowing everybody out of the water as this insurance company. And it's because your CEO, founder, or team of operators have come up with some incredible way to market or acquire new customers, right? And you're just absolutely crushing it. Well, the reason why another competing insurance company would want to take that employee and pay them more is because they want that trade secret. They want to figure out what the secret sauce is, right? So you become valuable because of the trade secret that you were taught by the company that you're at, and then you get poached because of that trade secret. So then that is tough because, you know, it is anti-competitive, but at the same time, like, that could severely undermine the business that the company has built, right? So, and there's no way that you're going to be able to ever protect that trade secret if the person goes with you, right? So I think in businesses where, like, intellectual property is very valuable to giving you the competitive edge in the workplace, I think that in that case, I could see a case for a non-compete being valuable in a competing industry. Whereas when it's more like a labor-based industry, I think non-competes are usually exploitative.
Nice. That all seems reasonable. And I think there's a couple of more things with this too. Like for the small business owner, this sadly is like a shrinking field of small business owners, and it kills me. But again, I think it's so hard to keep employees now. Like hiring is already difficult. And so now if there's, because you brought up like, how do you incentivize to keep employees? And I do believe it's actually relational in that like people, if you go to work and you enjoy the people that you're around, you're probably going to stick it out, even if it's a slightly smaller pay than a competitor. So I think the relational side of it's still huge. But it is a reality. It's like hard to find employees, especially in medicine right now. I know a lot of private practice offices are struggling. And again, I don't think that's all the staff has a non-compete. I don't know. But the other side of this too is there are two clauses in here. One is, would this even affect doctors? And this may or may not. It seems to be quite confusing and no one seems entirely sure, because there is what was the verbiage they used? Executive? Yeah, if you're an executive within a company, from the FTC, it says, well, if you have an existing non-compete, it might be enforceable, but after the 120 days, you won't be able to have a new non-compete. And then there's a salary threshold that's associated with it. So to be considered an executive, it's one, do you cross the salary threshold, which is arbitrarily, let's say, near $150,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And then $151,164 annually. And who are in policy making positions. So
that's
the senior executives, where the non-compete will be able to be enforced, is senior executives earning more than $151,164 annually and who are in policy making positions.
Right. And now I mentioned before, doctors are actually mostly employees now. And so with that subjective verbiage tagged to the second part of the stipulation, I don't believe personally doctors are actually in that position anymore. Like, we might be a more difficult commodity to replace for an employer just because of the financial investment up front and the lack of physicians across the country. But I don't believe we have much control in a lot of areas now within the actual medical practice. So I personally don't think that would apply to doctors, but honestly, it just depends on how a lawyer interprets this and how that gets read. But the second part of it too is, then there's another caveat for for-profit versus nonprofit organizations. And it's questionable whether nonprofit companies whether this non-compete exclusion or its non-compete ban will apply to nonprofit companies. So I'll read it to you and you guys tell us what you think, because I don't know. It's confusing. It's all legal jargon. So from the FTC website itself, this is a 570-page document. We're going to go through every page one line at a time. Actually, we're not. We're on page 52 for those of you who want to follow along. But the commission has a two-part test to determine whether a corporation is organized for profit and thus within the commission's jurisdiction. First part is, the not-for-profit jurisdictional exemption under Section 4 requires both that there be, one, an adequate nexus between organization activities and its alleged public purposes, and then two, net proceeds properly devoted to the recognized public rather than private interests. That sounds confusing to me, and they agreed. So they actually explained it further. Basically, they said the next line alternatively stated, because inferring we know that was confusing sounding, that one, the source of income, whether the corporation is organized for and actually engaged in business, is for only charitable purposes, and two, to the destination of income, to whether the corporation or its members derive a profit. And so where do hospitals and university systems fall in this? I don't know. Yeah, they take a profit. This is the kind of the whole sham of nonprofit. Whether it's a for-profit medical school or a nonprofit medical school, they're making a profit. The people work there make a profit. There's still money. It's just like, are the books open or closed, it seems like, at being the only endpoint. And I don't know where doctors and hospital systems are going to fall with this.
Yeah, it's tough, right? Because there's nonprofits that are technically nonprofits, but they are for-profit. Like, an example would be like Rolex. Rolex, I believe, is a nonprofit company, believe it or not. I think maybe, I don't know. There's a lot of organizations that are nonprofit. And then, theoretically, but a lot of the executives get paid really, really well in response to how well the company is doing. And in which case, I believe that it's saying that that's not technically a nonprofit because the members are benefiting tremendously from the upside. So technically it's like a structured as a nonprofit, but people are getting paid. Now, I think truly, like, you know, we are not lawyers and it's very difficult to interpret this law and this proceeding and some of the nuance to it. I think two things we're going to need to figure out for specifically the healthcare industry, which is, one, are they going to consider physicians and, you know, PAs and nurse practitioners to be policy making senior executives? So that's question number one. We don't know. And I think a case could be made both directions. And the way we're going to figure this out is through litigation over the next few years. Like, because there's going to be a case that comes up where there's a doctor who tries to leave and open up shop right next door, and which I think should be okay. I think the hospital will sue them. And I think the outcome of that case will essentially determine whether or not we consider physicians in most cases to be senior executives that are policy-making executives. Now, I think in practice, like Dr. Maxwell said, is that most doctors actually do not fit this criteria anymore, especially in a hospital system where they're pretty much never making the decisions anymore. So I think the argument certainly can be made that doctors are not policymakers and would not be bound by non-competes under this circumstance. So that's one. And then the second piece of this is whether or not nonprofits are going to be included, and those nonprofit hospital systems are going to be included in this. And that, I think, we're going to have to see again in litigation. There's going to be a lawsuit from some academic physician leaving the practice, and whether or not they sue or go after that person, that will determine probably the outcome of how we interpret this law going forward. But I do think that this is going to monumentally change a lot of businesses, and for some for better, some for worse, right? And so I think it should be really interesting to see kind of how it plays out. There's a lot of nuance in the skincare industry world with something like this, because a lot of skincare brands with their executives do have non-competes. And when those skincare brands are acquired by a new company, like let's say that you're a regular company, right? Like let's say you're Skin Better Science, right? Skin Better Science acquired by L'Oreal. Usually the executives have a non-compete that they can't leave and go to a competitive brand right away. But with this law, basically people will be able to leave, especially after this like executive period ends, and jump right to another competitive skincare brand. So how are they going to deal with something like that? It's going to be really interesting to see. And I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of litigation going forward, trying to figure out how this cookie is going to crumble. Overall, I think probably a net benefit once they figure out the nuance of this for workers, employees, and I think for employers to work harder to try to retain and give people a good work environment that's worth staying at. I think culture plays a big role in the success of a company, and trying to build that culture is very challenging, and incentivizing people, not even just financially, to want to stay at that job and be proud of the work that they're doing. And I think that's a challenge for all employers. And I think this is going to raise the bar to try to make working conditions better.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to go through a lot of litigation. In fact, the Chamber of Commerce has already started the process by suing the FTC about this in general. So it's going to start in litigation, go through litigation, end in litigation, and survive or die through litigation. We'll see how this one plays out.
Yes. And just a kind of heads up on this U.S. Chamber of Commerce litigation. They basically said there's a really good nugget here. I'm going to try to find it on the lawsuit. But basically that, you know, I can't find it right now, but the summary of it was essentially that, you know, it is very difficult to find employees and then train employees, and businesses put a lot of resources into training those employees to be able to be successful at their jobs. And for that reason, non-compete should be enforceable because there's a significant cost to the business to build this. And now that employee could get essentially trained. And as soon as they get trained, they go and they leave for a competitor who did not train them, right? So that's the angle I think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is taking, that this is going to be significantly harm businesses and small businesses who put a lot of effort into training employees. And we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce website, it says the FTC's action sets a dangerous precedent for government micromanagement. And then they say it will harm employees, employers, and the economy. But the thrust of that, which I still think thrust is the correct term, it is micromanagement by the government into the businesses. But again, it'll be actually a huge precedent set. Isn't
that the crux?
No, couldn't possibly be.
All right. Well, this is kind of heavy. You know, it should be interesting to see how it affects your industry. I'd love to see in the comments if you've ever been affected by a non-compete, whether you're an employer or an employee. I'd love to, you know, I think this is something where experience is going to play a big role here. And I'd love to hear just from people who have a little bit more experience dealing with something like this, what they've experienced and how they think this is going to affect things. This is a big monumental shift to the U.S. employment industry. And I think it's going to have far-reaching impact on everybody.
Yeah, I agree. Also, apologetically, a shout out to Charlotte Magic Water Cream. Look at my skin. If you've been watching my skin for the last hour,
good, right?
Looks good.
I'm telling you, it's a good nugget. Expensive though, so give it to us like 50% off, and I'll feel a little bit better about it, but still badly. So we covered a lot today. We covered unsexy products that actually work. We covered, the new launch of Remedy for body bumps, huge launch for us, and this new FTC ruling banning non-competes. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We appreciate and love all of you, and we will see you in next week's episode.
All right, we'll see you next time.